So I think just briefly to lay out the kind of ground for the conversation that we're going to have tonight, which we've slightly polemically named Housing Crisis, Design Feature or Design Flaw. I, as a housing activist, spend a lot of time looking at pretty outrageous figures on housing and wondering where the outrage is. I think if you look in Oxford alone, where we have 4,000 households on the council's waiting list, and we have a total housing stock of around 7,700 homes. We have an extra kind of 3,300 provided by housing associations on top of that. But when you look at those figures, you realise that that really is a crisis. And then when you look at those 4,000 households that are on the council's waiting list, and you realise that 1,700 of those either have small children or are expecting, you realise the kind of situation you are in. This is really something that is headed for disaster. We've tried really hard to use those people's situation as a design brief for this space. So we're open Wednesday to Saturday, 9 to 5. You don't have to pay to come in. We've got kids' toys, we've got craft tables, we've got free tea and coffee, and we've tried really hard to build a space where people can fulfill their rights as citizens in a space that simply doesn't really exist in the rest of Oxford. You have to spend money to be everywhere else. And so we're trying to create a space where lots of different voices can come and feed in to topics like the one we're going to be talking about tonight. So we've got three brilliant speakers who are going to speak between them for about 45 minutes, and then we're going to leave loads of time for you guys to give questions or comments. So first up, we've got Danny Dorling. Danny is a professor of human geography at the Oxford University School of Geography, and has written extensively on housing inequality. And is going to kick off the proceedings for us tonight.
Great. Thank you so much. Because I'm a professor, I have a handout, so you have to take something. Pass it back. Few of them back. I'll tell you what it is by the time it gets around. You may have seen them before. Why is the rent so high in Oxford? That's one of the questions. And why are there so many homeless people? But the rise in homelessness is easier, in a way, because the rise in homelessness has been very large, very recently, and it's been national. We've seen it across the whole country. Concentrated in particular cities, concentrated in London, concentrated in Manchester, concentrated in this city, in this county, because there isn't space, or you're not allowed to hang around in other parts of the county, you're pushed towards this place. The government produces figures as to the reasons why homelessness has increased, and the primary reason is that more people have been evicted by landlords because the rent has gone up and they haven't been able to pay the rent. That's been the main reason for the rise. But you have to go behind that kind of reason to work out how do we get into a situation where so many people are having to house themselves through the private sector. How did we do that? Why do we have more homeless people than other countries? Why do we have rising homelessness rates, whereas in other countries this is actually falling? Why has the number of dead bodies on the streets gone up tenfold in the last 5 years, as far as I can work out? And that's very, very fast, and that's very, very bad. I grew up in this city, and when I grew up, just down there, you could go to Bond Square and you could say hello to the two homeless men. There were only two of them. They were aged about 70, and it was a novelty. And then, in my teenage years, Margaret Thatcher's government changed the rules, and suddenly you saw some children on the street, because if you were 16 or 17 you couldn't apply for benefits anymore to be housed, and suddenly we saw a little rise in homelessness. Nothing like now. The rates of homelessness you get are political. It's a decision. It's a decision by governments as to what they are willing to put up with and what they're not willing to put up with. If you doubt me on this, simply go across to the United States, and you can see what they're quite happy to put up with in the United States, and you see people, if they're lucky, sleeping in cars. Or go to Canada, which is much better than the States. So much better than the States that people actually walk up from the southern states to be homeless in cities like Ottawa, where it was minus 20 last week, because it's safer to be homeless in Ottawa than it is to be homeless in the USA. But Canada's still worse than us, has actually more homeless than us. We'll then go across and look at the rest of Europe, and you'll see huge, huge variations, generally lower than us, and in places like Finland, the rate is dropping. So it's a decision, it's not something which happens by accident. Why is the rent so high? When I was a university student, I paid £9 a week. £9 a week in my second year. In my third year, I paid £13 a week. There's been a little bit of inflation, I'm not that young, but not that much. The reason is that we had housing relatively well sorted out in the past. In fact, one of the things that this country was better at than almost any other country in the world was housing. In the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, the policy of this country in terms of housing and providing social housing and seeing housing as a right and getting Labour and Conservative governments to compete to build housing was unprecedented. It was so unprecedented that the United States became very, very scared of it. The UK was actually seen as the big enemy, spreading a non-market philosophy of housing that had to be stopped. There's a lovely woman called Nancy Quack, K-W-A-K, who's written the definitive world history of housing. And it makes you proud to be British, because you don't often see things that we were good at, given we did an empire and all the rest, it isn't that nice. But worldwide housing policy, we were the leader on how you house the population, how you make sure that everybody can get a home of a decent standard. We never quite got there. But we weren't just heading that way. We were also helping the rest of the world look at models that worked. The market works for some things. The things that will be in this shop, I wonder what the shop was before it closed down. But whatever the things in this shop were, they're probably trinkets, and they're the kind of thing where the private market works well. You don't really want the state telling you what trinkets you get. The market works well for your clothes, generally. Although in a more unequal country like Britain, you can be persuaded to buy clothes you don't need. The market works well for small items that you repeat purchase many times because you become a good consumer of them. Where the market fails is one-off large bulky purchases. One-off large bulky purchases are much better done by the state because you're all idiots. You don't know how to do it. You think you do, but you don't. I've spent my whole life working in universities. I can sell you a degree. I know what I'm doing. I've worked in universities for 30 years. I could go, God, that's worth £9,250 a year. Such high quality. And because, of course, you only buy an undergraduate degree once, you don't know what you're doing. Right? So things like education are done far better for the state. That is obvious to most of the world. Most of the world has a state education system for most people. Most of Europe has a state education system at universities. Only particularly stupid countries go in for private education at tertiary level. Health. Some of the older ones of us may have experienced heart surgery. Believe me, you don't want to do it. You don't want to become an expert at it. Again, health is better provided through the state. Now, housing is interesting because housing is a kind of mix. Housing is well provided when roughly half your population is being serviced in one way or the other by the state. It doesn't have to be social housing or council housing. It can be good government regulation on private rents, which is what you get in Germany, what you get even more in Vienna and Austria. But housing only appears to work well when the state intervenes with at least half of the stock. Otherwise, things begin to go wrong. People begin to amass more and more houses. They get greedy landlords are successful landlords. I don't know if any of you fancy being a landlord, but if you're fancying being a landlord for it to work, you have to not fix the boiler. If you fix the boiler and then some tenant doesn't pay the rent and something else, you'll find you don't quite make enough money, and the landlord who's a bit more mean will actually beat you and now buy the next house. So the private landlord system encourages greediness. Let me talk a little bit about Oxford. Has anybody got one of these handouts now? Okay. Oxford's fairly unique in the UK. Almost everywhere else in the UK, the housing problem could be solved internally. Even London, there are more bedrooms in London than there are people. So in London, and this is not including the hotels and the hostels, in London you could house everybody simply with the existing stock. You wouldn't need to build any more. The luxury flats that the Chinese have built are very useful. It's really nice they've built them all. We just have to work out a way of using them. But anyway, Oxford's your only place where you can't actually house everybody who needs to be housed here with the stock you've got. We've reached, Becky Tunstall is a friend of mine, sent me the figures yesterday from the 81-91 2011 census, and we are a remarkably well-packed city. There is some empty housing and some underuse of housing, but generally it's pretty low. And our problem is we've got 40,000 people driving across Greenbelt every day. They're working in the city. They need to be housed. There are all the people with children or having children we mentioned earlier. If people growing up in Oxford, living in Oxford, are going to be able to stay in Oxford, Oxford needs to be a bit bigger. I'll give you my trite summary of what happened to Oxford. Little map of the box, little eight maps in Mark Fransham. Here's the development of the city. By the 1830s, we're allowing university lecturers to actually say they're having sex. Because they were allowed to admit to having sex, they always had sex, but because they could admit to having sex, they could have houses, and they built houses at the Bamboo and Woodstock Road. That's why you get the orange beginning there. And because the university lecturers were not used to making their own beds or feeding themselves, they had to have servants. They'd always have servants in the colleges, which is why the big houses on the Bamboo Road have basements and attics for the servants. By 1900, the orange areas are the new built areas. The city's becoming a bit more normal. It really was just a weird monastery kind of place before then. By 1939, we're really building. Proper Midlands town. It's got a car factory. Big production line. And then by 1970, you can see the rest of the infilling in the building. And then it stops. Nothing in the 80s, nothing in the 90s, nothing in the 2000s, almost nothing in this decade. Tiny bit of West Park. Quite incredible. Bang, hit the brick wall, stopped. Part of what happened was that the car factory went from about 40,000 workers, and these were 40,000 largely men, largely with families, largely with children, so that's a lot more than 40,000 people. To what it is today, which is about 3,000. Again, still largely men, but largely young men without families. And that huge reduction in people from 40,000 families to 3,000 largely single people opened up a space. And the two universities filled that space. And the hospitals filled that space. And the other industries filled that space. And that's partly why you get this crisis now, because that space has all been filled, it's all been taken up. Oxford has two production lines now. It still has a mini production line. The mini production line produces more minis than ever. The mini every 1 minute, 3 seconds, something like that. How much does a mini go for? Anybody know? 20 or 25, 30,000? Quite a lot. The second production line is students, particularly postgraduate students, which I think are costing roughly the same as a mini. But they take up more space. Anyway, two production lines in the city. The city can't fit it. What was supposed to happen and what didn't happen? The map on the back, the big map, is the 1927 plan. I will stop in less than 5 minutes. This is the 1927 plan for the expansion of Oxford. If any of you are fascinated by Oxford, it contains the original plan for the Ring Road. You'll see that the Ring Road is largely as it was supposed to be, except it doesn't go through Marston. You'll see the areas of flooding, which are actually much bigger than the green areas they thought. But the key thing is it's a circle. The plan for Oxford was for it to be a big circle. The reason it's to be a circle is that the main mode of transport back in 1927, and when I was a child in the 60s and the 70s, was the bicycle. Most people were cycling. And they don't want to cycle too far, because it's hard work cycling. So the idea was that Oxford would expand to that size. Exactly the same year, in 1927, the Oxford Preservation Trust was formed. Now, it wasn't just the Oxford Preservation Trust that stopped it. It was the colleges as well, and the general feeling of you can't have this special town become an industrial Midlands town. And you can't have this county becoming a Labour county, which is what would have happened. But that's why we have this incredible tight green belt. That's why you can look about a mile that way to Hinksey Heights Golf Course and wonder why we have a golf course within a mile of the centre of the city. It's why you can walk 500 metres north of the John Radcliffe Hospital, a hospital that cannot get nurses and midwives, and you can walk into fields. I mean, honestly, it's pitiful. It's absolutely pitiful. So we need to revisit the 1927 plan. The city is artificially constrained. Government after government didn't change it because, I mean, to put it bluntly, they all lost their virginity here. And you don't want the place where you lost your virginity to be changed. I mean, I could be more polite, but it gets me angry, and I've been in this city long enough. And you have to, you know, this is the most expensive city in the country. 17 times average earnings for average price. It's more expensive than London. You have to begin to call out the reasons why it's happening. But I would end up by being positive about it. One nice thing about the Greenbelt and the Oxford Preservation Trust is that we don't have sprawl, which we'd otherwise got, and we don't have detached houses with free garages around the edge of the city. We actually have them up Jack Straw's Lane, near where I live, but anyway. You know, they're hidden away under trees, you wouldn't know they're there. And there aren't too many of them. The city isn't surrounded by large houses for very, very well-off London commuters. The city is surrounded by land waiting to be used. And if you want to know how to use it, go to the Netherlands. Go to Groningen. Go to Delft. Go and see how they do it. And they have apartments, and the apartments are 5 stories high. And you cycle. You can get everywhere by car. It just takes much, much longer. And we don't have to invent it because it already exists. We need a city of about 75,000 more people. The alternative is taking out one of the universities. Personally, I'd take out the old one because that would be fun. But anyway, you can take out one of the universities, or you take the hospitals out and find somewhere else in the county to put them. It's not going to happen. This is an artificially shrunk city between Birmingham and London. It could be the greenest city in Europe. You know, we're not very good at this in the UK. But Oxford needs to be expanded in a way that means that you're looking at 50% of people using bikes, not less than 20%. People walking, and the housing needs to be provided in a way that is allocated by needs, not by the market. The legislation you use is Newtown legislation. It's still on the books from the 1960s. It's all entirely possible. You just require a government who's committed to do it. Why do we think there's a chance there's a government committed to do it? Because 3 colleges are selling their land. They're selling their land on the edge of Oxford because they know, and you'll see the little advert for that. I'm not a member of the Labour Party, but I was doing a Labour Party talk, so you'll see it there. John Healey, the Shadow Housing Minister, has said that Labour government, when it comes to power, will buy at agricultural price land on the edge of cities. Agricultural price is as near to zero as you can get. The governing bodies of free colleges have decided to sell their land for the first 90 centuries because of the chance that they might get near to zero. The sad thing is that developers are trying to build on that land and build detached houses with free garages for London commuters. So what I'd like you all to do is to help the Oxford Preservation Trust in the next couple of years stop those developments occurring, help the NIMBYs, and wait until you get a decent government in power who can actually work out how to provide proper housing for people in need, who can actually work and keep the cities running and servicing. Because this city doesn't work. My telephone hasn't worked for a year in my office. If you try and get a new deputy head or head of a primary school, you can't get one. Ask where the head of St Greg's has gone, or the deputy head. Right? It's amazing how things can fall apart. But the city increasingly isn't working. What other city has adverts for bus drivers on the side of buses? You know, you can see how desperate it's getting. You can carry on. At the extremes, you'll see people on the streets with all their belongings. But behind that, you'll see three families on a semi-detached house with three bedrooms in Moral Avenue. A family in each bedroom. It's quite incredible what's going on. You're there, postgraduate students. I won't do a poll here. My standard thing with postgraduate students is I ask them where they're living, and they say they're sharing with another postgraduate student, and then after two pints, they tell them about the other two students who are living illegally with them. We're packing an enormous number of people into this city. We can tell because we can look at the sewage. So we've actually got an idea of how many people are actually living here. It's a mess and it needs to be sorted out. And it goes all the way from people being homeless on the streets right through to why colleges cannot hire associate professors who'll stay for more than 3 years unless they have inherited wealth. It's a complete mess and it needs sorting out. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Danny, and I hope you're all feeling wildly optimistic about the rest of the evening, the rest of this year. Danny's provided a beautiful segue into our next speaker, who comes from her role as a senior best practice officer at Crisis UK, so working in the national housing team. The work that she's doing has people with the most extreme need at its heart, and then more recently over the last year has spent some time travelling around the Netherlands, around California, around Scandinavia, looking at co-housing as an alternative model to how we might provide affordable housing for young people. So Ella, if you want to tell us some more.
Yeah, great, thank you. Hi everyone, I'm Ella. You have to forgive me for not standing up, but 8 months pregnant, I think it's probably safer if I just sit down. But just give me a wave if you can't hear me at any point. So as Lucy said, I work for Crisis, and we're the national charity for single homeless people. And I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of the impact of the housing crisis on our members, our service users, but mostly I'm going to talk about sort of the research that I've done this year looking at co-housing, looking at affordable co-housing, and kind of give you some best practice examples. So I'm not going to say too much. I will give a plug to the Crisis plan to end homelessness. So if you haven't seen this, this is the mini version. So there's a big version which is 250 pages if you fancy it, but there is a kind of a mini version which is much more accessible. But that is a report that we published this year to not celebrate, commemorate our 50th year of existence. We don't want to be here again in 50 years. So we ran a whole sort of consultation process with lots of experts, lots of people with lived experience to produce a plan to end homelessness. There's kind of lots of really practical solutions in there, so do take a look. But I did want to just mention sort of two main structural issues which have been driving homelessness and affecting people's abilities to exit homelessness. And the first of which is the gross housing undersupply of genuinely affordable housing. And that's meant that fewer people have been able to access social housing, can afford to buy, sorry, and there are many, much, much fewer social housing tenancies than there were. More people are living in the private rented sector, so there's obviously increased competition to access the private rented sector. And there's also been increased barriers for people on low incomes to access social housing. So we know kind of there's been a real increase in the use of affordability tests for people who are on low income. So even those that should be eligible for it, kind of are really getting stuck on these affordability criteria issues. And the second main problem has been welfare reform. So really looking at the local housing allowance, which is how housing benefits are set, that was at the 30th percentile, which wasn't really adequate then, but then it's been frozen until 2020, and that has just meant that the gaps between what is affordable for those in receipt of housing benefit or universal credit and market rents is just continuing to kind of widen. Also, there has been an extension of the shared accommodation rate. So for people that are under 35 and in receipt of housing benefit or universal credit, you are only entitled to what's called the shared accommodation rate, which will only get you a room in a shared house. That was previously up to 25 and it's been extended now up to 35, which has meant that there's been a lot more people in receipt of benefits looking for shared accommodation, and there haven't been enough accommodation out there, and standards have really been affected by that as well. And then lastly, universal credit, which, you know, as I'm sure we all know, has been a bit of a nightmare. Sort of, you know, rollout has been beset by administration errors and delays and deductions for people that are on very low incomes. So all of that has kind of meant that the most obvious and sort of most dangerous form of homelessness, which we would anticipate to be rough sleeping, has risen 169% nationally since 2010. But really, that's just one aspect of homelessness and a small part of homelessness. I think our research recently said that there were almost 160,000 households experiencing homelessness in Great Britain. And we know that if nothing changes, that's likely to double in the next 25 years. So we really kind of at a point of crisis. And we know that there's two main changes that are going to make a huge impact to that number, and that is looking again at welfare reform and the supply of housing. So at Crisis, we look, and we have looked through the development of the plan, at evidence-based solutions to those issues. I myself have been focused, I've been at Crisis for 5 years, and I've been focused on looking at shared accommodation, so supporting organisations which we call Help to Rent projects, so voluntary sector organisations that support people into the private rented sector, supporting them to set up shared tenancies for people who are experiencing homelessness or on very, very low incomes. But also more recently looking at how the role social landlords can play in that, because increasingly social landlords are looking to set up shared tenancies. So again, their sort of initial feeling is that it's going to be an absolute nightmare, and how do you manage, you know, four people under one roof? But we've done quite a lot of work looking at how they can best support those tenancies, how best people can be best prepared to go into shared tenancies and live with other people, and how they can kind of continue to manage them. So I've been doing that for about 5 years, and I've really seen the kind of the positive impact that shared housing can have, especially on young people, when it's really well managed, in terms of minimising the risk of isolation, you know, really helping people establish those peer support networks and integration into the wider community. But unfortunately, those kind of well managed projects are few and far between. So, and for lots of people, it can be very isolating, especially young people that might have come out of the care system, or have just gone through hostels to supported housing and not really had any kind of say in terms of where they live and who they live with and how they live. So I started thinking about what's the alternative. So how can we better involve young people in their housing, specifically around shared housing, and what role co-housing could play in that. So I applied for some funding from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust last year, on a bit of a whim, if I'm honest, to look at co-housing, and to look specifically at examples of affordable co-housing, because I was really interested in what was the social landlord's role in this, and could they actually be encouraged to, in their new developments, think about co-housing, at least thinking about kind of the principles of integration into the community, integration into the wider community, self-governance, sort of resident participation that comes with co-housing, to develop shared housing projects that were a lot more meaningful for the young people involved. So I went to, and yeah, just a disclaimer, I am literally at the point where I'm just looking at my findings, so I'd love to come with a whole load of recommendations and, you know, a fantastic report, and I have got to do that in the next couple of months. Baby, you'll be fine, I'm sure. but I am just, yeah, so I haven't got kind of any real recommendations, but I wanted to share with you some of the best practice examples that I did come across. So I visited 30-odd projects and organisations in America, so California and New York, in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam and Utrecht and Delft, and also in Sweden, in Stockholm and Linköping. My pronunciation.
Would you mind just giving a quick definition of co-housing?
Yes, oh, I can try, yeah. So co-housing, to my mind, is about kind of intentional communities. And I guess the traditional setup of co-housing would be where you have a number of individual houses that are on sort of one plot of land, but that you also have your sort of shared spaces, communal spaces. So there's a real sort of division between your private spaces, so your own apartments or your own houses, and then your shared spaces, which would be normally sort of a common house, but also could extend to mean communal gardens and play areas, and I saw some projects that had workshops and knitting rooms and shared chickens and absolutely loads of
It's called community housing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a part of community housing. So is that helpful? Yeah. So, but there's also, that's kind of the traditional idea of co-housing. There's also some retrofit co-housing that I went to visit in America, which is looking at how existing buildings can be bought to become a community. So there was one project I went to in America that basically one person had a shared house and then he just went round and bought all the other houses, knocked down the walls, and then created this kind of really interesting community where people lived privately but also very much kind of together. So I visited some owner-occupied co-housing communities, which is kind of, I guess, the regular idea of what you might have in your head when you think about co-housing. Also some rented co-housing communities, which were delivered by social landlords, and some other various housing projects for young people. So for example, some Housing First projects, some other projects in America that looked at lodgings for young people, and other sort of bits and bobs as well. And I just wanted to share some examples with you of some really interesting projects that I went to, and just kind of thinking about how social landlords specifically can get involved in delivering co-housing or thinking about co-housing when they're creating new developments. So I went to one in Sweden called, again my pronunciation, Collective Hus Stolpliken, which was huge. It was the kind of the biggest, I think one of the biggest co-housing communities that I've seen, and not your traditional setup of owner-occupiers and then sort of shared spaces. It was much more like a huge social housing block, and there were 180 apartments and 300 odd residents that were living there. It was developed and built by the in the 1980s by a community group who approached the social landlord, a housing association, to take it on, and they still own the complex. So 43 of the 180 apartments are rented at social rents to elderly residents who have got carers living there, but also some are rented out to people with autism. And they're all kind of very much involved in the community. Residents were originally involved in the kind of design process, and it's all connected by an internal walkway, which I was in there in 30 degree heat wave, but they did tell me that in Swedish winters that's very helpful because you don't actually have to leave the building. You literally kind of get around to all the common areas just going internally. And also there were sort of very huge, very big windows which encouraged integration and sort of community, communication with your other residents. This was the project that had, hundreds of facilities, really everything that you could imagine, so sort of from communal laundries to a knitting room to cafes to cinema rooms to other sort of dining rooms, loads and loads and loads of communal shared facilities, and all residents paid £15 a year to pay for those facilities, and that was a really purposeful decision on behalf of the housing association to keep it low to make sure that it was accessible to everybody that was living there. There were some real challenges with that project in that because it was housing association run and the local authority leased out a lot of the communal areas, and so during the day the residents couldn't really use them, and there was also some really complicated rules around who had the keys for which room. So if somebody fancied doing some woodwork of an evening, they had to find that one person that had the key to the woodwork room. So logistically it was a bit of a nightmare, I think, because of the size, but it was really interesting to see how co-housing could be delivered by social landlords at scale, at a huge scale. So I also visited a project called Bridgebrugt in Amsterdam, which was again started by a community group in 2010. They had originally just had an idea to build a sort of regular co-housing community, but they just really struggled to get any finances to get it off the ground. So they contacted Dekai Housing Association, who are quite a progressive housing association out in the Netherlands, and they run lots of housing projects for young people. And Dekai said that they would pay for half the apartments that they were building, but they wanted, in return, they wanted the community to be the co-housing development to have a lot of other amenities and facilities for the community. So there was a nursery, and a theatre, and a cafe, and a restaurant, all attached to the same development. And they've got 52 apartments that are all owner-occupied, but they've also got two apartments which are shared houses that are for people with learning disabilities, and they have a carer on site. And they really take part in the communal activities, and I spoke to Jane, whose daughter has lived there since 2007, and she's got severe learning disabilities, and she sort of talked to me about how much more independent her daughter is now, and how much she really kind of really appreciates the fact that she's able to engage with the community, and how positive it is living in such a social community. She volunteers, actually she works in the cafe now, and she kind of gets that informal support from her neighbours in terms of if she needs a lift somewhere, or help with shopping, or help filling out forms. You know, that's all kind of provided by the by the neighbours. I'm conscious of time. How am I doing?
A minute or two more.
So I will give you an example of one that didn't work so well, and that is in San Francisco, in called Petaluma Avenue Homes, and this is the whole reason I wanted to go to San Francisco, because it is a specific affordable co-housing project for those that are just on low income. So whereas the other ones were kind of mixed tenure, this was just for people who were on the equivalent of the waiting, you know, the housing register or the waiting list for social housing. And it was developed with two of the leading architects around co-housing in the States. So kind of design-wise, it was very successful. You know, you had to go through the common house to get to the individual houses, which were townhouses and apartments as well. So it really encouraged people to kind of engage with the community. It was 45 units and about 100 people live there. It's a very nice place to live, clearly, but it hasn't worked as co-housing. And they had a co-housing consultant that came on board that was supposed to spend time with residents talking about how this was a different kind of housing project for them, housing offer for them, and what it would mean to kind of be involved in the community, etc. But they just found that people needed somewhere to live, and you know, that was kind of their main prerogative for most of the residents there. Not all, some were more involved in the community side of things, but the kind of quite strict housing rules there around income and eligibility for social housing meant that they only had between 3 to 6 months to work with individual tenants to sort of talk about how it meant, what it meant to live in a co-housing community. So that time was really not long enough, and people didn't have enough buy-in really to the communal way of living. So it still exists, and it's still, like I said, a really nice place to live, but it just doesn't really operate as a co-housing community. So it's an example of where it didn't perhaps work so well. There's lots more that I could tell you about, but I'm conscious of time. But I am going to write a report, so if you're interested, do have a look. I've got a blog as well. And just to say, we do at Crisis, we have continued to fund some shared housing projects, shared social housing projects. So if you're interested in that, give us a shout as well.
Thank you. Just before we move on to Ella, can you show me if you're the right temperature? So if you're the right temperature like this, and then if you're too, wait, no, if you're too hot like this, if you're the right temperature like this, if you're too cold like this.
It's
going to
be a bit awkward, isn't it?
Okay, we're good.
Don't get out of such
a way. Jack's too hot, but he's always too hot. So I think, you know, it's really interesting hearing about these lessons of co-housing and how some of these ideas are actually already in practice and working in other places. These aren't hypothetical ideas. I think just a quick shout out that Oxford has a really thriving co-housing community. So there's a couple of people in this room who I'm sure will identify themselves in the questions, but anyone interested in these kind of ideas, then Oxford is a good place to be for it, and these are ideas that are already working in other places. So in our series of Housing Matters, what we're trying really hard to do is show you working examples from places close to Oxford, and one of I'd say the country's most exciting community-led housing schemes. So co-housing is one form of community-led housing, but community-led housing is a wider system. One of the most exciting community-led housing projects that we've got is a project called RUS, which is the Rural Urban Synthesis Society, which has just had planning this June to build 33 units of accommodation at a social rent using passive house technology, which is a super environmentally friendly and low carbon building technique. And our next speaker and final speaker, Sarah, works for a brilliant architecture practice in London called Archetype, and has been working on the RUS project.
Thank you.
So hopefully the project
will... Stand up?
So hopefully we can I can give you some hope and some inspiration for how we can do things differently. To start with, I'd like to introduce you to Kareem, this chap here, and his dad Dave. Kareem grew up in a house that his mum and dad self-built in the 1980s in Lewisham. And it's a scheme called Walter's Way, which is one of the pioneering self-build schemes that the architect Walter Siegel was involved in initiating. This is a great book, which if you want to have a flick through during the question and answers or at the end, you're welcome to have a look. And just to kind of give some background on these schemes, they were simple timber frame construction that anybody could build themselves. And Lewisham Council was inspired by this German-born architect, Walter Siegel, and thought that this could be an opportunity for people who are on the council waiting list to build their own homes in Lewisham. And there were a number of sites where this happened. And it was something that was really pioneering. And I'll just put the book down for 1 second. And Kareem, who'd grown up in this house that his mum and dad had built, he set up the Rural Urban Synthesis Society with the aim of creating that same opportunity for his generation. He realised when he set it up in 2009 that there was no way he could afford to rent in the borough that he'd grown up in, and the chances of buying a home in the borough he'd grown up in were very well out of sight. So he wanted to create something for his generation. And so RUS, it's a bit of a mouthful, the Rural Urban Synthesis Society, is a member-led community land trust, and it's founded with the aim of creating sustainable community-led neighbourhoods and truly affordable homes across London. For any of you who are not familiar with community land trusts, the idea is that they act as long-term stewards of housing, so ensuring that it remains genuinely affordable, not just for the first generation of residents, but for future residents too. And this affordability and perpetuity can only be achieved by ensuring that that house prices can only increase in line with salary increases, not the open market. And so the site that RUS are hoping to build these homes on is in an area of Lewisham called Ladywell. And they started campaigning for community-led housing in the borough over 6 years ago, and it took them a long period of time to actually secure a site that they could then work on developing a scheme to get planning permission for. And the site itself is particularly challenging. And when you look at some of the sites where these homes were built in the 80s, they're some of the most difficult sites that no developer would go near. And the site that we're working on is a similar site. So it's located very close to a conservation area. It's down an incredibly narrow road. There's a river on one of the boundaries and a railway line. So there's lots of different factors to consider in terms of flooding, working with the Environment Agency, contamination, lots of issues like that. So there wasn't actually any competition for the site from other developers, but still RUS had to go through a competitive process in order to secure the site from the council. And in terms of actually offering the council any money for the site, RUS worked out exactly how much it will cost to bring the site up to a standard where you could actually build homes on it, and then explain that to the council. And so the value of what RUS are offering is actually the fact that RUS will transform the site into being suitable for housing and then provide 100% affordable housing on it. So that's a bit about the site. The residents group themselves were selected after a public ballot in March 2016, and the applicants had to demonstrate their connection to the local area either by living or working in Lewisham, and they also had to meet some key affordability criteria. Lucy said that it's 100% social rent. It's actually a combination of four different types of rent of tenure. So we've got social rent, where people are coming from the council's housing waiting list. We've got affordable rent, which is linked to average salaries in Lewisham. Then we've got shared ownership and shared equity. And RUS, as an organisation, retains 20% of the value of all of the homes, which is another factor in making the homes more affordable. So there's a whole range of different types of tenure, and the idea was that it really would be a mixed community, and the different types of tenure cross-subsidise the scheme and make it possible. We started a co-design process with the residents group back in the spring of 2016, and we started with a festival of ideas, which was an opportunity to meet all the residents for the first time, for them to see the site, and we also started talking about design and some of the basic principles that would be discussed throughout the design process. So we were talking about the overall site, landscape and gardens, the building materials and character, internal layouts and sustainability. And we used precedent images, so we brought different photographs of different schemes, and we showed them to people to try and understand what they liked, what they didn't like, and for them to start working as a group. Because this was the residents group, which is 33 households, were coming together for the first time. Some of them were RUS members, but others were very new to the project and the ideas. And then after that festival of ideas, which was across a weekend, we then had a series of evening sessions where we looked at specific aspects in more detail. So we had a whole evening just looking at the site, landscape and gardens. And after each session, we prepared a design menu, because it's very hard for all households to come to all of the sessions. So what we tried to do was capture everything that had come up, all the decisions that were made, discussions that happened, and that could be sent to all the residents after the sessions. We also filmed all the sessions so people could watch them again and catch up that way. And as well as talking about the overall design of the scheme, so the kind of principles for the site and the overall brief, we also wanted to get the residents to input on the design of the internal spaces within their flats and houses. So we had a customisation process, and we gave the residents a series of options that they could choose from based on the size of their unit and also based on the location on the site. And so we've got one beds up to four beds, so it's a real range of units that sit together along the site. And we wanted to give the residents a meaningful choice, but we also had to balance this alongside the reality that we couldn't design 33 different homes with the fee that we had and the time that we had, so we had to make sure there was enough flexibility for people to have some influence. And we also tried to ensure future flexibility by not having any structural walls internally within people's flats. So there's just one or two columns within a flat or a house. So in the future, residents can move things around. And with that, we were actually torn between what the residents want and what the planners wanted to see for the planning application. Because if you look back to some of these schemes from the 80s, there's a lot of flexibility in terms of what residents could choose. They could maybe move bathrooms around, everything around as they were building their homes. But actually, for our planning application, the planners wanted to know exactly where the bathrooms were, what was behind that window, who was overlooking who. So it's quite difficult to balance those agendas. And externally, it's really important for us, for the scheme to read as a whole, but also to give opportunities for the residents to have some individual expression. So there's areas around people's front doors which can be customised. Generally, all of the cladding will be made from the same material, but residents can choose the modules that they want to clad their homes in. So they can choose different sizes. They might also cut patterns out or stain the materials in different ways. Just talking about how this is going to be constructed, it's a self-build scheme, and the residents want to build as much themselves as they can. And this is partly because it can save them money. So it can, they can save up to 15% of the cost of their home by self-building. It also offers the potential for skills training, and it will give residents a greater sense of ownership, having created the homes themselves. But due to the scale of the scheme, which is actually 3 and 4 storeys across the site, it means that people can't just build their own home. They might be in a 1-bedroom flat at the top of the scheme. So if they waited, they'd be waiting a long time until you actually got to bear part of it. So all of the residents that want to self-build will be working together as a team, and they'll be contracted to build packages of work as part of the process. So they might be hanging doors across the scheme, or they might be building partitions, but they'll be doing all of that together. So that's quite different to some of these schemes from the 80s. Okay, great. So just to sum up, I just wanted to add something about sustainability. It's really important for Rust that the project is sustainable, and that's sustainability in its broadest sense. So we're talking about socially, environmentally and economically sustainable. And the scheme has been designed using Passive House principles. The idea behind that is to achieve optimum internal comfort and for the lowest possible energy consumption. And ultimately, the sustainability of the scheme will have the biggest impact on the residents, because they will be the ones paying the bills in the future. So trying to get that right at this stage is really key. And although this is one small project in London, we do have hope that it will lead to more projects like this. Russ is a member of London Citizens, and we took part in the London Mayoral Assembly in 2016 to challenge the mayoral candidates on their housing policies. And Sadiq Khan committed to achieve 1,000 community land trust homes in London by 2020. So we're watching this space to see more projects like Russ.
I think Sarah is playing down that last little comment, which was one of the most genius bits of campaigning I've ever seen, where London Citizens managed to get the mayoral candidates on a stage in front of the press and ask them whether they would commit to building 1,000 community land trust affordable homes. So they had nowhere to go, and they of course all said yes, including Sadiq Khan, and that's been very powerful for that kind of development in London. And it's also really worth noting that there's this very wonderful pot of money that is available at the moment from central government called the Community Housing Fund. So this is £163 million, which has been made available by central government for groups looking to explore community-led housing. So it's not capital cost, it's to pay you to get consultancy or advice or do land surveys or do feasibility studies. So for every one of you groups of friends who has had that conversation about starting your future commune or starting a co-op or moving to an island and living together, now really is the time. There's a really remarkable moment to get started on community-led housing, and there's lots of people in this room who'd be more than happy to help you. We've got about half an hour for questions. Looking around the room, there's a really remarkable amount of experience in this room, and personally as a chair, I love comments, so I will happily take comments as well as questions. But I would just ask that if you make a comment, A, tell me it's a comment before you start, and then try and keep it really nice and brief, because I'm sure there's lots of people in the room that would like to join in. And I'm going to just take a couple of questions at a time, and then we'll ask them. So hands nice and high if you've got a question. Okay, great, we'll take left.
You're all about trying to take houses down which were from the thing, weren't you, earlier on. How are we going to stop them? Which way do we do it?
Okay.
And in the red?
Comment. There's a really good documentary about the Lewisham...
Can you speak up?
There's a really good documentary about the Lewisham building from the 80s. That I can't remember the name, but...
About Walter's Way?
Yeah, which is really interesting.
I think it's called The House That Mum and Dad Built.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Really worth watching.
And one more at the back.
I wondered what the link was in Oxford. Like, you mentioned that there was land that the colleges were trying to sell, and where the land is that you would do a community housing, and how you quickly get it.
Danny, do you want to start?
I think the immediate thing is to stop people building executive housing on the edge of Oxfordshire, because it's very hard to tear it down later. We've got people from the Green Party here who are very opposed to it, so...
Not necessarily
opposed to the executive housing. I don't know.
Opposed to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Oxford's famous for NIMBYs, but I just think it really is worth looking at the schemes that Christchurch and St John's, all the rich colleges, are involved in. And they're trying to maximise the profit for their incredibly high endowments to get even bigger. Just, you know, if it's necessary, write to their governing body and say, why do they need to do this? And don't they realise they're part of the problem? It'll all come up in the next couple of years or less, because the schemes are coming through so fast. Over getting the land you want, the easiest place to get land for community housing is a long way away from Oxford, where it's cheaper. So the most successful scheme I know is in Leeds. So it's not much fun if you're in Oxford, but where these schemes in Britain work is where the land is cheap. The biggest problem is the land cost. I think it's interesting. I think we've been discussing where we'd ideally want to be. Ideally, you want to be in a world where people are designing their own housing and communities. And we've got a crisis. And that's very different. We're going to have 100... Last year, we had 130,000 kids in B&B rooms on Christmas Day. And they're not going to be housed in their adult lifetime by community housing. So there are two separate problems. There is, how do you solve the immediate housing problem for the next 20 years for most people? And there is the aspiration for community land trust. And I'm being blunt, if you were to double, and double again community land trust in this country, you still don't solve the problem for 1% of people. So you've got to see the two things as separate. Small pockets, like you said in London, undevelopable, tricky pockets are the most likely to occur. So the Lilac scheme in Leeds actually is in a poor part of Leeds. There are lots of poor parts in Leeds, but it's a particularly poor part, and has a major electricity cable running under the site, which limits where you can put the houses. And it's interesting, in practice, it's those kind of places that end up working. But we do, I reiterate the thing, for the bulk of people, for 99% of people in this city, for all those parents who are pregnant at the moment and on the housing waiting list, you're going to need the state to provide the housing. There is no other way of doing it within half their lifetimes. So these are two separate things. Community land trusts are great for enthusiastic people with time. The couple who started the scheme in Leeds are friends of mine. He's a professor of the urban future at the University of Leeds, and his partner's a doctor. You know, they're very, very able. An ex-leader of the Green Party is one of the tenants. It works for very able, well-resourced people. But for the bulk of the population, the housing will not be created by themselves, at least in our lifetimes.
Okay. Did either of you two want to come back to any of those points?
I think so.
I'm hoping there might be some comments from people coming around. Hands up. So we'll take these two and one in the person with the green.
Because Danny was saying, obviously, great ideas for the future, but I'm really about the problem, like here and now, with the homelessness and what I see. And one of the things that obviously a lot of people are talking from an Oxford point of view, and although I do come in and help with the homelessness and that and lots of things, I'm very aware that West Oxfordshire District Council is a very affluent area. Robert Courts, it was David Cameron, send all the homeless over to you, which actually, like all the other authorities do. So it's also about, I think, having that conversation and making people be a lot more accountable to what they're doing. So if you look at pockets of how we can, I mean, they say they've just done two houses, beautiful houses in Whitney, for six people. I mean, the land, the garden is 100 odd foot each. They could have extended, built, come up again, and house 20 young people in there. It's the mind that's thinking behind it, do you know what I mean? They're just not. And so we've got to make it real. And so with those 3-foot floors, and it's actually, we've got to go much higher. We're going to have to be a lot smaller.
Okay, so we've got one point about going higher.
It's a question for Danny. Do you think that university has somehow contributed to the crisis, the homeless crisis, by pushing the prices in the rented accommodation, and also by buying units of housing, social housing or affordable housing like they did in Fernham Court?
Great, and one more over here.
Thanks for all the talks. I was at the start thinking about Ella's, you were talking about co-housing and specifically looking at the San Francisco scheme. Mm-hmm. So I've lived in Stockholm in Sweden and I've been to the Netherlands, and realizing the culture there and the rental market there is quite different. What do you think about the context of Oxford with regards to how unsuccessful the San Francisco scheme was? Because San Francisco's context is that it's a very expensive place to live, so people would just want to go there to find a place to live. How can that issue not be replicated here in Oxford, or do you feel it would be different?
Should we start with that final question?
Yeah, I don't know is the answer. I think, you know, you're absolutely right, and I think that scheme didn't work for those reasons, that actually, you know, there is a real kind of issue around homelessness in San Francisco. I mean, having worked and lived in London, I don't know Oxford that well, so I can't kind of comment too much on that. But coming out of the metro in San Francisco, jaw hits the ground. You know, it's so shocking. I think it was an interesting project, and it was really interesting to go speak to the housing association that had set it up, and their aspirations were absolutely on point. You know, they wanted to do it because they wanted to really sort of change the way that social housing was being developed and was being delivered. But I think that, you know, with the housing crisis, actually having total social housing in that instance, perhaps, you know, it didn't work. So I don't know what the answer is. I think that, you know, there's some kind of interesting stuff around mixed tenure that might be sort of worth exploring. But yeah, I mean, this is a kind of ideal model, and I guess, you know, as Danny was saying, actually the housing crisis is what we need to be looking at in terms of, you know, increasing access to the private rental sector, building more social housing, so that this could be an option and it's not sort of necessarily what people have to go into. So for people who are interested in it and interested in that way of living, you know, this could be a really positive option.
And I wonder if, just before we move on to Nadine's point, if Sarah, you could speak a little bit to, in some ways there is of course a need for state provision of providing more houses, but within the role of CLTs and other community-led housing, there is perhaps a model for starting to break the stranglehold that private landlords have on the private rental market, which of course Russ is looking to, and also might feed to Deborah's point around the need for these new kind of developments. I wondered if you could speak to that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with all the kind of points of the reality that the problem is so big that the projects like this that take a long time to happen aren't going to solve the problems overnight. But I think there's a lot of interest in people having a say in where they live and the quality of the homes they live in. And I think once there are more projects that have happened and that when there are more examples to look to, hopefully councils will be more supportive and more forthcoming about these small pockets of land that they have and that aren't very easy to develop. And there could be more small initiatives to use some of those spaces.
And Danny, the elephant in the room, the role of the uni.
The role of the uni, I forgot the uni. It's interesting. San Francisco's got a famous uni as well. And it's also the next place west where the ratio is 17 to 1. So if you're finding an equivalent to Oxford, it's San Francisco for housing. And I first went there in 1995, so was that 23 years ago? And I had to step over bodies because the homelessness was so high. And this is the fear. And I was going to a conference of 5,000 geographers, and I went to a session on poverty, and there were only 7 people sitting in the hall because they didn't care. You know, that's what I learned in San Francisco. The university have kind of got it wrong slowly, so it's not deliberate. You know, paying house allowances doesn't help. Slightly flaunting the agreement over postgraduate students doesn't help, Brooks doesn't help, but also the city deciding to stay artificially small doesn't help. You know, I think it's an overall problem. It's not just the university. The university doesn't understand, by the university I mean, there probably somebody in the room, but the people in Wellington Square, which is what, 50 metres away from us, you know, that's the centre of the university. The university honestly doesn't understand that for the university to work, the schools have to work, and the garbage has to work, and the rest of the city has to work. The university thinks that's the responsibility of the city and county council, and doesn't realise that its ownership and control of land is so big that it can't just renege on that. The university also currently supports the expressway. The expressway is better known as the Outer M25. It's a motorway planned between Oxford and Cambridge, which allows you to build 300,000 houses in the countryside, which you can all get to by car. So that'll solve it. And see if we can get our pollution levels up to San Francisco, because we're not quite there yet. So what's really interesting is how the university gets things wrong, I say in my arrogant way. And it's because it's so separated from the rest of the society, it doesn't realise the problems or the issues of being a city, but also because of this coincidence of the car factory having shrunk at exactly the same time and rate at which the universities were growing, so they could move into each other's spaces. And that's why the problem has suddenly come across us, because it's only very recently. Lastly, just to make you feel happy about all, if you go to County Centre and go to the estate agent that's literally on the edge of County Centre, you'll see for the first time in my life housing in Littlemore reduced 10 or 20% at the moment. It's never happened in Oxford before. So currently we don't know where we are. I know somebody selling a house on the edge of London for 1.7 million who will happily sell it you for 1 million at the moment. Brexit makes things exciting, but yeah, everything's up in the air. I mean, what's remarkable about housing is we have a crisis from people being on the street to people owning 1.7 million houses willing to quickly sell it to you for 1 million because they're really scared that they won't be able to sell their house. Yeah, we've remarkably mucked the whole thing up. And our banks are completely reliant on the value of housing. And in the 585-page Brexit deal, there are only 115 words about the banks. And it's March 29th. And if they have no passporting by March 29th, they're not necessarily solvent. And that's really bad news if you like things being slow like me. On the other hand, you know, if you're interested in new schemes of arranging everything differently, you know, we are kind of, you know, you couldn't plan it better to really, really damage things. 40% of these people in this country essentially vote Conservative because they think the value of their house will be kept high. When and if that goes, we don't know what will happen. And it all depends on what happens in the next few months between now and the 29th of March, on the sentiment on the market, on the feeling about Britain, on the realisation that there is no plan for our banks, and the banks cannot actually function if they're not allowed to operate on the mainland of Europe, because London is the hub of the European banking system. It's a fascinating time. I can't tell you what's going to happen. I'm just trying to say. And in the 1970s, last time we had little housing, well, a crash bigger than 89, people bought at auction at the very bottom, cheaply. I've got no idea better than you what's going to happen.
It's an interesting point, and one that I hope that we can keep provoking by being sat in the middle of Jericho saying that the housing market isn't working for many people, surrounded by a lot of people for whom it's working very well. So I think we need to keep having those conversations loudly. Hands up. Okay, we're going to go here, then we're going to go right at the back, and then we're going to go here.
Although March 29th feels very close, it sounds like with changes to the universal credit, there are people who are going to lose their house in the next month when they can't pay their rent. I wonder if you can talk about sort of what we can do right now for those people who are currently housed but are right on the edge?
Well, we tried to go up against Barclay Hope.
Who's we, sorry, and would you mind speaking up a little bit?
Yes. A group of housing activists a number of years ago tried to stop Barclay Homes developing in North Oxford, and it was impossible because they were so powerful. What's the strategy for stopping the power of the volume house builders to bulldoze everything and put very low density housing on prime sites? Thanks.
Yes, I agree with you, Danny, and one of the reasons I was tempted to vote Brexit was that it would all go in chaos. City might go, housing might, go right down. But the one thing, more practically at the moment, that I was wondering what you think of is there was a plan. We had an architect, I think some of the other Green councillors, who actually worked free to make plans for housing over the park and rides. Yeah. And at first I thought, no, it doesn't sound very nice. But actually they did some wonderful drawings. We've got 5 big park and rides around Oxford. We've got the car park behind Tesco that could actually take another layer there. What do you think about that? And small units that are sort of not expensive, but acceptable and good to live on.
Ella, would you like to start with the point over here about people on the edge at the moment?
Yeah, I would direct you to the plan to end homelessness, which has got lots of good suggestions in terms of solutions. In terms of universal credit, we know that there's a real paucity in sort of staff training, and I think that's kind of where all the administration errors are happening, and people are kind of getting into arrears before they're actually moving into property, so there's a lot kind of to be done around that. We also need to look at the local housing allowance and how it's set, to bring it back at least to the 30th centile, and working with organisations like Help to Rent projects to try and encourage landlords to let to people that are on very, very low incomes or kind of in a seat of housing benefit. We also called for, there is £20 million, there was a recent funding that came out that's gone to local authorities, but to work with Help to Rent projects to do just that, to improve access to the private rented sector. But also we need to look at kind of property conditions in the private rented sector, a national register of landlords. You know, there are kind of lots of evidence-based solutions, but it's just getting that political backing. Government's making a lot of the right noises, but not necessarily moving in the right direction.
And Sarah, I wondered if you wanted to speak to the gentleman's point at the back in terms of potential strategies against mass house building. Is that something you've come up against much?
I guess we aren't kind of activists in the way that it sounds like you are, but all we can do is champion good examples of housing. And I think the more people see these positive examples in the Netherlands, in other parts of Europe, the more councils are persuaded of the merits of those ways of doing things. So I think as architects, all we can do is try and do better and not engage in projects that we don't believe in. But we don't have that much influence. We're limited by what we can do.
I think it's worth speaking to a project in London called START, which I'm sure you've heard of, the St Anne's Redevelopment Trust, but that is certainly a project that's happening at a much bigger scale. I think it's 400 homes?
I think so, yeah.
Which is starting to speak towards a viable alternative for some of that kind of scale housing, but you're entirely right that it's a drop in the water compared to some of the investment that these Barratt homes are making. Danny, did you want to come in?
Yeah, part of the park and ride. But one reason I handed out a 1927 plan is it wasn't a plan for something to happen immediately. It was kind of like a plan for 50 years. Now, it didn't happen by 1977. By 1977, here was pretty grotty. I know here was pretty grotty because my mum and dad had me here. And because they thought it was too grotty, they bought a house for 400 quid next to County Centre, because that was massively upmarket compared to Jericho back then. So just things really do change a lot in 50 years. The map I didn't explain on there is the little cycle routes going out, because I just think it's amazing we don't have cycle routes away from cars going out into Oxfordshire. The Park and Ride, why wouldn't they do it? My horrible feeling is that they want a second and third tier of cars. And if you go to towns like Northampton, all the way around London, about a mile out of London, there are these train stations and there's a triple, you know, even quadruple deck car park for London commuters. And I think that the reason why they wouldn't go for the housing scheme that the Greens suggested is because there's a quiet plan to have 80,000 people driving over the Greenbelt. It's not that quiet. That's why the expressway is being proposed and the 300,000 houses in the countryside. So you do need to build housing on top of the Park and Ride. You do need to build it over the car park at the back of Tesco's. You need to halve the number of cars in the city. You need to make all the arterial routes one way. You need to take away the college car parks, particularly Christchurch, which is enormous. You know, if you're going to start anywhere, I'll start with Christchurch's car park. I know people there have got four cars parked there from one member of staff. So, I mean, it's, you know, you couldn't make it up. But you get the number of cars out of the city. Everywhere's still got to be accessible by cars, but you get the cars out. It's not fanciful, this is what a Dutch city looks like. And that's part of how you increase housing. But what you can't do in Oxford, at least even I don't think this is possible, is you can't build up within the middle of the city because of the views. But that's why you want to build around the edge, because you've got these nice hills and you can see the views. I don't think it's possible. You see it in Switzerland, in Basel, which is a very similar city to Oxford in size. There's a tower block right in the middle of the city. And the tower block is for the elderly, very, very elderly. So you can spend the last few weeks of your life actually looking at the rest of the city and seeing some mountains. Now, we can't imagine doing that, building a tower block and looking down at quads. But anyway, you know, that is fantasy. But a Dutch-style city by 2050, you ask, why can the developers get away with it? Why Barclays Home can get away with it? It's because we have no plan. If there is actually no plan for the city that says this is where you want to be in the next decade, decade after that, decade after that, then the developer can say this will be a good idea. We can't say no, it won't be a good idea because it goes against the plan. We don't have a plan. The council will tell you they have a plan, right, but it really isn't a plan. It's a plan to do nothing, except occasionally look at developers who come along with ideas. You do need to plan cities. If you want a functional city, you know, lots of my friends are anarchists, I really like anarchists, but, you know, a city needs to be planned, because it's about transport and about housing and about jobs, and it's about long-term thinking, and it's about how you get the water in and how you get the sewage out. And at the moment, amazingly in Britain, we've gone against planning. So we don't even plan where we put our new secondary schools. You know, the latest secondary school in the city, the first one to be built since 1955. Somebody was just allowed to put their finger on the map and say, I think I'd like it there, please. You know, so we put it on a bit of land that floods in the posh part of the city. If you want, I could tell you, if you want the next secondary school, St Peter's Fields just south of Hinksey would be very good. You can cycle across to that, but I shouldn't be making it up. I mean, we're in a ridiculous situation in Oxford where we don't even plan where our schools go anymore.
I've got time for two more questions, and there's one here that's been squirming in his for a while. And one more at the back, just there. So I'll take those two and then we'll wrap up.
Well, it's a question and a comment. I mean, if you were to cut round the built-up area of Oxford and plonk that silhouette onto Paris or Barcelona, you could fit a million people into it. Mm. Now, building up doesn't mean 10, 12, 20 stories. We're allowed to build from 4 to 7 stories in the view cones, for example, and Brooks is just about to try and do it.
Yeah.
The problem is that, you know, the entire city is one big brownfield site. You know, that, you know, your lovely eight maps on that show the development of this, you know, the interwar housing, which will not survive environmentally much longer. You know, it's bad housing. I mean, people love it, obviously, you know, Parker Morris Plan A kind of thing, but it's not good housing. But and the reason why the planning doesn't work is that they don't have a mechanism to not force but encourage people to think about the economic costs of what they occupy. So the question is, we're sitting on something that's been going around the sun for 3.5 billion years. Humanity's been here for maybe 250,000, and for 99.9% of that time it was common property. And someday, about 1,000 years ago, someone woke up and said, oh, I know, I'll have that and I'll rent it out to everyone else. Who on earth thinks, literally, who on earth really believes that we can own in perpetuity a piece of this earth that we're all utterly dependent on? We should be paying each other for it and forcing the economic costs to be squeezed out.
Cool, I'm going to cut you off there, so we've got time for one more.
Okay, so this is in between a question and a comment. When there is talk about the housing crisis in the UK, one solution that's often put forward and was mentioned tonight was comparing this country to places like the Netherlands or many other Northern European countries, where generally people build up and people build quite dense houses. But I feel that to an extent, that might always only have average success, because in the UK, people place a lot of symbolic value on having a detached house. Like, obviously you get people buying flats and being really happy in them, but this never seems to hold like the symbolic importance that a detached house has. So I'm wondering if there is any scope for our cities and this country to develop in a more sustainable way, while at the same time kind of like scratching that itch that a lot of people have, to have something which they feel only belongs to them and satisfies that, that house-owning urge, you could say.
Brilliant. Two fantastic final comments about ideology and symbology. I'll just take a final comment from each of you. Danny, you want to start?
Yeah, you're right. There are all kinds of land value tax proposals. We will get one eventually that means we'll all own it. It doesn't have to become Barcelona or Paris because you limit it by the bike. That's how you limit the size of Oxford. And this is the city of the bike. It's where the bike was manufactured for the first time. The English and their little cottage with the roses round the door is fascinating. I think it's got to do with empire. And it's the reward you had when you went away for 20 or 30 years to India and abused people. When you came back, what you got was the detached house. You actually left the tenement and you came back to a detached house. I think it's a temporary problem we have mentally, and it's particularly a home counties thing, and it's associated with roses and cottages, and we don't understand that you're actually better off in an apartment, particularly as you get old, and it's got a lift with no stairs. No stairs is wonderful as you get older, and particularly if it's well insulated and if you're getting heat off your neighbours. As well. I agree we've got a huge problem. I just think it's a temporary problem that comes with a very, very strange country that this country has been. And it's not a terminal problem, but we can learn to love apartments.
Great. Not terminal, learn to love apartments. Ellen, final comments.
You're just kind of on that point in terms of our obsession with home ownership. I think there's a lot to learn from, you know, from European countries in terms of improving access to the private rented sector and the stability of renting. If we can kind of look at that, then perhaps we can move away from this national obsession with home ownership.
There are small pockets of land out there, and there are sources of funding for groups who want to do something together. And there are people who have done it before to learn from. So if we have more things like this and more conversations about it, hopefully there'll be more projects like that.
Brilliant. If you'd just like to join me in thanking our speakers. I'm going to wrap up really quickly. because I know that Ella has to run away from a train, but just to say that we're going to be here for a year. And so use us, make most of us, come visit us. We're going to have lots of events, keep an eye online. And we are looking for volunteers, so if anyone wants to come and hang out with us in the daytime, we're open Wednesday to Saturday 10 to 5, that would be wonderful. And please do talk about us. We're a very small team, you're basically looking at it. And so we'd love everyone to tell everyone they know about it, because that would be really helpful.
And I am going to say, Thursday is ladies only.
What a nerd, yeah.
You forgot that.
So, yeah. Thanks for coming. Really appreciate it.